This is Amber Ray
and Rusty Tanton,
and you're listening to Mostly ITP on the Georgia Podcast Network, the show focused on all things Atlanta and sometimes elsewhere.
Okay, I'm Boyd Lewis, and I have a photography exhibition here at the Mason Muir Gallery, 199 Armor Drive, and that's in the SOB section of Atlanta, south of Buckhead. It's right off of the Buford Highway in the Warehouse District. And I just had an opening last night of my showing called That 70s Atlanta. And this is 75 photographs of what Atlanta was like during the 1970s. Everything from hippies in Piedmont Park to urban pioneers in Grant Park to Appalachians in Cabbage Town, to the rise of the black political empowerment in the wake of the assassination of Martin Luther King, the election of Andy Young in 1972, the election of Maynard Jackson in 1973, both of which are very historic, and every civil rights leader you can think of, from Rosa Parks and Jesse Jackson to Daddy King and Julian Bond and John Lewis. So that's essentially what the photographs are, black and white photojournalism, classic Life magazine style.
Very cool. So we were talking on the phone just a little earlier, and you were telling us the reception was a pretty big hit last night. About how many people showed up to that?
I think about 300 people. They were expecting about 100, 150, but the article in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution on Friday, which was really big, had a lot of pictures, and was really nice by Bo Emerson, I think almost doubled our expectation. So we had about 300 folks of all varieties. I mean, we had representatives there from the black newspapers. We had people there from the political establishment. We had three members of the Atlanta City Council come by, and so I mean, the numbers are impressive, I guess. But I was really impressed by the sheer diversity of the people who came by. You even had young girls with piercings and tattoos.
Excellent. Well, some of the folks, probably the folks who listen to our podcasts, are going to be a little younger and might not remember like the Great Speckled Bird and the Atlanta Enquirer. Could you just, I guess for our audience, give a little overview of what it was like to be around during that time and to cover this sort of rise of Atlanta, the sort of new regime that's been around?
Right. Okay, well, I think no matter how young and feckless you happen to be, you probably heard of Martin Luther King Jr.
Absolutely.
And Dr. King had died 15 months before I arrived in Atlanta in the summer of 1969 and was hired by the Atlanta Voice newspaper. The Atlanta Voice had direct connections to Dr. King because it was founded after his assassination by Ed Clayton, who was a veteran journalist and who was Dr. King's communications director. And after the assassination, Ed Clayton founded a newspaper, and he died shortly after, and it was taken over by J. Lowell Ware, kind of a legendary figure in black journalism in the city. It was kept going by Ed Clayton's widow, Zernona Clayton, whom some people may recognize as the founder of the Trumpet Awards, and she's a former vice president of Turner Broadcasting. Uh-huh. So, you know, I was kind of in the middle of Dr. King's world. And the late John Calhoun, who was just a fearless civil rights advocate from back in the 1940s, looked at me and says, "You working with Mr. Ware over at the Voice?" And I say, "Yes, sir, I guess I am." And he says, "You're that white boy with the black press." And so the title stuck. And, you know, I was white. I'll always be white. When I'm dead, I'll be very, very white. So I worked in Martin King's world. And yeah. it was a blessing. It was a mitzvah. You know, if you know your Hebrew, and it was just a marvelous time, and I was walking around with a camera, taking pictures of everything that moved, and I lived in Grant Park back when it was still sort of a Victorian slum. I lived in Midtown when it was full of hippies. I was always in Piedmont Park, and Piedmont Park had been taken over by hippies. And if you went to that Piedmont Park concert with the Dave Matthews Band and the Allman Brothers, then that's basically what it was like for about a year and a half in Piedmont Park. Hippies, concerts, you know, smoking dope, urinating on trees, walking dogs, crying babies. it was really a magical period in Atlanta's history. And that whole decade of the 70s was like that. And it came to an end only with the beginning of the missing and murdered children's cases in the summer of 1979. So it was almost a perfect decade run where we all lived. I mean, everybody, white, black, businessman, neighborhood, you know, activist, rich, poor, we all lived according to what we thought Dr. King would approve of. And it was, and that time of being a beloved community was brought to a shuddering halt when Atlanta's children started to go missing and to be murdered. And that was in the summer of 79. So that's kind of a thumbnail description of what that magical decade in the 1970s was like. And it could come around again. You know, we had that happen without Martin Luther King. And we could do the same thing without Martin Luther King. Only I think we have to get off of our entertainment Jones and our greed and our, you know, endlessly wanting things and goodies, and start to look at the idea of community and maybe make a life within the shadow of all these godless skyscrapers that have gone up in Atlanta.
Well, it's sort of hard for me to imagine, having grown up here, all I've really known as far as like what passes for a counterculture is creative loafing, and as far as media.
Oh,
and I know.
I'm the first editor of creative loafing. Yeah. I know its heritage, and I look at it today, and I just go, oh, yeah, gag me with a fork.
I know. And I mean, you know, what passes for counterculture in this city is a company that owns papers in several states. I mean, I'm not really trying to make this a slag on creative loafing podcast, but just, I mean, it does seem like there's a dearth of real countercultural voices coming out that I guess have a sort of business model like the Speckled Bird did at the same time, where they can actually make money from advertisers and things. And
right.
I mean, what do you think, needs to be done to sort of revive that? I mean, do you have any ideas about it?
Yeah, I think you have to look at how the counterculture developed and evolved in Atlanta during that time. It came really on the heels of the civil rights movement, of the anti-war movement, of the women's movement, of the gay liberation movement. There were things that were moving that gave energy to the counterculture and gave the idea of the counterculture that what you do is to say to the predominant culture, you know, up yours, and we're going to create something that makes sense for us. And there were no leaders. There were no real institutions. It developed because, you know, somebody here and somebody over there said, I'm going to make a new world, and it begins with me. And and then I'm going to influence somebody else, and that somebody's going to influence somebody else. And it was like a telephone tree. One person calls 10, each one of those calls 10, and so on and so on. And pretty soon, you've got a movement, you've got institutions, you've got leaders, and the whole legacy of Dr. King, which informed the counterculture in this town to its roots, to its bone, to its heart, to its soul. You know, without Martin Luther King, I don't think there would have been a counterculture in Atlanta anything like it was, because you really had to have that rebellion against a system of segregation and of authorized racism. And it had to be fierce. And it had to take the nature of children marching against fire hoses and police dogs. And once you saw that, you were never the same. And the counterculture in Atlanta, especially the hippie movement, came directly out of that experience with the civil rights movement. A lot of those people who were, you know, what we call hippies, but also some short-haired people who had very radical notions in their head, you know, were actual veterans of the civil rights movement, had been with SNCC in the Mississippi Freedom Summer, and had braved death, you know, threats from the Ku Klux Klan, and they came back to Atlanta, and they said, well, there's no Ku Klux Klan in Atlanta, but there's racism in Atlanta, and we're going to take it on, you know, we're going to take it on head on. So it was a movement that proceeded almost person by person. And we don't have a civil rights movement to speak of today, but we have great causes. You know, and the Iraq War is the greatest one of all. And I think anybody who is appalled by the hole that we're being drugged down, and even with the official Democratic Party not putting up too much of a fuss, you know, we're being dragged to the depths of hell. And if that's not a cause for a counterculture movement to come and to really articulate a different way that we can live, then I don't think there's any hope for the rational human being. I think we might as well all follow Michael Stipe and my boyhood heroes, REM from Athens, Georgia. It's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine.
Well, I mean, it's pretty easy to get depressed about the state of things if you start thinking about the Iraq War. I mean, obviously, this is something that 70 or 80% of the country at this point realizes was a bad idea. Why has it been so hard to galvanize more opposition to this thing?
Because people haven't moved to take over the Democratic Party, which is the opposition, the way people moved to take over the power structure in the wake of the civil rights movement. You know, the Democratic Party has lost its heart and soul because they are just, and I don't know if I can say this on a podcast.
You can say whatever you want. Yeah, chicken shit's fine.
Chicken shit.
Yeah.
And, you know, they don't have the hearts, they don't have the cojones, they don't have the will to take on George Bush and everything he stands for and treat George Bush as a traitor, as a maniac, as a delusional paranoid who doesn't care what 80 or 90% of the American people think or do. He's going to do whatever he goddamn well wants, and his religious fanatic believers think that he's going to bring about the end time, the revelation time, and bring about the return of Jesus. And this is George Bush. He's got, I'm not kidding. And a lot of very professional psychiatrists, psychologists have studied the actions of this man, and they say he shows every sign of someone who's a delusional paranoid.
Dry drunk is, yeah.
His own sense of reality, and he doesn't care what the mass popular will does. And I'm a member of the United Teachers of Los Angeles. I'm a teacher in L.A.
Uh-huh.
And you know, our union is discussing in very serious terms a national shutdown, a strike. You know, the teachers start it and everybody else piles on. And we just shut the country down to show the Democratic Party that we are serious, that you do not compromise with the devil. You do not compromise with evil. You do not compromise with somebody who has such a weird and wacky and dangerous, thoroughly lunatic, dangerous mindset that George Bush has. You don't negotiate. You don't meet him halfway. You push him back, you put him in his box, and you put the box away so he doesn't crawl out and try to kill our children again. I'm sorry. I haven't had breakfast yet. And I'm paranoid delusional because, you know, I had a great night last night hobnobbing with the civil rights leaders, my heroes, people like Congressman John Lewis. And I am just so infuriated that people like John Lewis are not being listened to in the halls of Congress, and that we've got all these wacky Republican idiots like the one who beat Max Cleland, that ignorant cracker who took an authentic Vietnam War hero and portrayed him as a buddy of Osama bin Laden. I don't even know who that motherfucker was. I'm sorry, I didn't say that.
You can say whatever you want.
I don't know who that gentleman was, but, you know, for him to portray Max Cleland, the triple amputee from Vietnam, as unpatriotic when he had never served in the military himself.
I think you're talking about,
even out there in California, I was just, you know, flipping. I was throwing my shoe at the television.
Anyway, you
got to get that sense of outrage.
Yes, exactly. I guess you were referring to Saxby Chambliss, who I would agree with you.
Was that the name of the ignorant cracker?
Okay. He's Saxby, a real...
Saxby Chambliss. Saxby, if you're listening to me, and I know this is being monitored by the NSA and the FBI and Karl Rove and, the late Karl Rove and Dick Cheney, but Saxby, listen up. You ignorant mofo, I meet you on the street, I take you down, man.
Dude, I would pay to see that. That would be very entertaining. Well, I guess back to Atlanta, because I could go on about Saxby and George Bush all day, believe me, because I'm not fond of them either.
It's not enough just to bitch about him.
Yeah.
It's not enough just to sit around and say,
I know.
You know, like in the civil rights movement, it was not enough to say, you know, oh, Bull Connor is kind of bad for beating those kids up and sticking the fire hoses and the police dogs on him. Oh, isn't that a shame? No, you moved.
Well,
you
here's
took
the thing.
Action.
Like, one thing, I remember back in during the, I guess it was a 2004 election, like 500,000 people went and marched on New York. And it really didn't get much coverage outside of C-SPAN. If they try to take that kind of action, it doesn't seem to have any effect. I mean, what course of action would you suggest besides that? Because just going and marching on a place doesn't seem to do it anymore.
Well, what you do is march on a place and then do something. You know, you have a sit-in right there, and you have a teach-in right there. Use some of the templates of the 1960s and of the 1970s. and use them not just to bring people together and sing Kumbaya, but you bring people together and say, you know, this war is tearing the heart and the guts and the liver and the stomach and the intestines out of this country, and it is going to drag us down a financial pit. It's going to drag us into the throne of blood, you know, to use Kurosawa's phrase. And, you know, just for people to get authentically outraged, and then you do something. If the mainstream media doesn't cover it, this gives rise to something like a 21st century of the edition of the Great Speckled Bird. Mm-hmm. Only you call it something else. And you have, you know, action plans. You report on what happened. If there's police repression, you report on that. If there's First Amendment violation, you report on that. If people are rounded up and their Fourth Amendment protections are violated, or their Fifth Amendment protections, you violate that. You go into federal buildings and you read the Declaration of Independence, and you show the government what justifies a rebellion against government. And everything the colonists thought was justifying the American Revolution applies to the current and present day. And when people get that serious, you know, we're talking small r revolution. We're talking like an orange revolution that took the East, or a purple revolution that turned Eastern Europe away from communism. People just refused to work with a communist government, and they shut the government down. And this is the kind of thing that maybe we need in this country. Everybody decent, you know, go on strike, gather in the park. We're going to read the Declaration of Independence and talk very seriously about what us as an individual can do to bring about a social transformation. And don't follow any revolutionary leaders. Don't follow any revolutionary movements. You know, everybody's got to be the revolution within themselves. You know, the power of the individual is awesome. The late Margaret Mead, the anthropologist, said, "Don't ever doubt that a small group of dedicated people can change the world. Indeed, that's the only thing that ever has." You know, think Christianity. Mm-hmm. Think the civil rights movement that started with Mohandas Gandhi and with Martin King. Small group of people, but change their worlds. Small group. You don't need a mass movement. You don't need media. You don't need mass anything. You just get a small group of people, and you discuss, you know, what are the things that can be done to stop this oppressive government from overflowing into our lives, and then go out and do it. This is where Martin Luther King's dream mm-hmm. turns into action.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I've got to leave in about 5 minutes.
Okay. Well, I guess last question then. Do you read any blogs?
No, I don't. I'm a teacher. I don't have time to do internet surfing of any kind. I don't use that as my entertainment. What I do for entertainment is I come home from teaching 12-year-olds and I take a nap, and then I get about to grading and lesson planning.
I mean, I guess you could sort of make a pro and con argument about blog sort of trying to be that voice that takes over where people can get information that's outside of the mainstream media, but at the same time, they're not always doing real journalism. It's also more commentary sometimes. I write a blog,
and
so
it's not always that accurate.
Yeah,
you know, all the stuff about Israel being behind the Twin Towers collapse on September the 11th, 2001. You know, you get a lot of that on the blogs, and
that's actually not really been my experience, because I have lots of friends who are bloggers, and it's not so much that there's a lot of inaccuracy floating around most of the blogs that I read. It's more that, you know, it's people with day jobs. They don't have time to do real journalism, and that's really more the issue with it as far as I can see. And I don't know, I guess I would like to see something that is the modern day equivalent of a Great Speckled Bird pop up. And I don't quite see it yet, and I'm just wondering how and when it's going to happen.
Well, it's still developing.
Yeah.
You know, and I have great faith in the internet to put people together and to assemble ideas and to mount that sense of outrage in the way that the Great Speckled Bird did back in the 60s and 70s. And I think that's the only thing, really, that we can depend on to get the real news out, as opposed to the massaged news, the manufactured news, mm-hmm. and the news that makes us want to go out and buy something. And I have tremendous faith in the internet, but you got to be careful. Some of the stuff out there is simply not right. Some of it is manipulative. Some of it, frankly, is corporate-based and has its own agenda.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have to be a wise consumer about what, about your information.
I think that applies whether...
You've got to cross-reference it by reading magazines like Harper's and The Atlantic and the New York Sunday Times, and you have to look at, you know, the best of the established mainstream media. Forget television. Turn off the goddamn tube. Don't listen to a word it says. It's nice, pretty pictures. But I was a journalist for 30 years before I became a teacher, and I turn on television today. You know, I watch Keith Olbermann. All right, and my wife and my wife is now telling us that we have got to go.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for speaking with me here, Boyd, and good luck with the show.
This is the hook coming from the from stage left to drag the clown back backstage.
All right.
But it's been delightful talking to you, and you know, keep the faith. You know, I'm very happy to talk to you and your audience, and everybody get by and see my show. It's going to be the 70s Atlanta. That's the title of it. Mason Muir Gallery, 199 Armor Drive. And what you do is go north on the 85, you spin off on Buford Highway, and then at the very first exit that says Piedmont Monroe Lenox, you go ahead and take that exit, you just keep going around to the right, back under the expressway, and you go into the warehouse district, and it's a big old building.
All right. Well, thanks so much for talking to me, Boyd.
Righto. Okay. And you keep doing the Lord's work.
The song you heard in this podcast was Flux by Drop Trio, available only on Magnatune.com.
Thanks for listening to Mostly ITP on the Georgia Podcast Network. Visit us at gapodcastnetwork.com. If you have a question, comment, or drunken rant, leave us a voicemail by calling 678-389-9441. Who knows, it might be featured in a podcast. You can also email us at info@gapodcastnetwork.com.